It is undoubtedly one of the most dangerous places on the entire planet.
Whoever did this was not your typical killer. There's something much more impersonal behind this than anything I'd ever seen in my career. Something colder.
37-year-old Lorena Salas found dead in her home. The killer believed to have drugged her, then set up an elaborate contraption around her home, which ended in her decapitation.
This is The Heads of Sierra Blanca.
Welcome to Episode 4 of The Heads of Sierra Blanca, our podcast reinvestigating the Rubedeck killings that took place in Sierra Blanca, Texas, in 2007.
Last episode, we were leaving the home of terrible father, amateur taxidermist, and Rubedeck suspect Wayne Doyle. And as is standard practice for this podcast, we turned all relevant evidence over to the police. Wayne Doyle was then taken into custody by law enforcement. After some resistance, he submitted to a DNA test. This DNA comparison to the blood found on the Rubedeck's camera fully exonerated him. Another dead end.
But another thread we picked back up last episode wasn't. Since the start of this show, we've been in communication with the team behind the website that, for legal purposes, we've been calling StreamLeaks. The Rubedeck's uploader account, Headless, had pings from 4 different IP addresses. The last 3 were logged from the victims' homes, but we found that the first was logged in Juarez, Mexico, the same location cited in the letter received by Dr. Lopez in Episode 2. It's highly unlikely that this is a coincidence, which means it's worth investigating.
Going to Juarez to record conversations prodding into unsolved murders isn't something to be taken lightly. I talked to Johan Hari from Episode 1. He spent a lot of time reporting on Juarez while he was there writing his book, Chasing the Scream. And this is the advice he had to give us.
Well, you mustn't go on your own. That would be a really stupid thing to do. So it's very disorientating to be in a branch of Wendy's and realize that murdering you would be legal. Effectively legal.
So we shouldn't go then?
You know, go, but go with a fixer. It's not very expensive and it will save your life.
So, there you have it.
We still need to talk to Alex about it, though.
Okay. Alex Aldea is the founder of the Paragon Collective Podcast Network and also a producer on The Heads of Sierra Blanca.
Hello?
We filled him in on everything and then made the ask. We'd like to go to Juarez.
Look, I never feel comfortable asking you to put yourself in danger.
Okay, I'll rephrase it. I'm not asking. I'm telling you. We're going to Juarez to follow this thing up.
If you can just wait 2 days, it'll at least give me time to set you up with a fixer and secure you, okay?
That's fine. Thanks for the help.
Another point of contention was evidence gathering. I've never worked a case outside of the States before. I wanted to touch base with DA Espada before our trip to discuss the logistics, as well as potential legal ramifications of working abroad.
Hello?
Hi, DA Espada, it's Lena.
Hi, Lena. What can I help you with?
So how does evidence gathering work in a foreign country? Does anything change in the American court system when information is procured from Mexico?
Well, hi, Monica. That's a great question. It's actually not any different than here. If you work with the local police and use the same techniques when handling evidence, then everything should be fine.
Forgive my ignorance, DA Espada, but didn't Dog the Bounty Hunter get arrested for working in Mexico?
He was trying to catch an American fugitive. He apprehended him and brought him across the border. That's obviously not legal. There are proper extradition protocols to deal with fugitives, though don't sweat it. I actually worked a case in Mexico 20 years ago.
Yeah? What do you mean?
Well, early in my career, I started off as a public defender. I had a murder case where my client claimed he was acting in self-defense, that the victim killed one of his family members in Mexico, and he was trying to defend himself. The problem was we didn't have any record of it, and the Mexican authorities were inundated. So I lobbied for the time off and went to Mexico for 2 weeks to collect evidence.
Well, then what happened?
We eventually found what we needed to verify my client's story. He was exonerated.
Wow.
So keep your head up. My main piece of advice is to stay safe, and if you find anything, tell us, okay?
Of course.
Thank you.
That story at least left me with hope. What we were doing wasn't unprecedented.
Before our trip, the other thing we had to discuss was the environment we were walking into.
To get a sense of how Juarez has changed, we talked to a friend of the show, Tony Hajar. Tony is most well known for playing in a post-rock group from El Paso, Texas, called At the Drive-In. He used to go to Juarez all the time as a high school student in the 90s.
Back then, we would get IDs when we were 16 years old that said we were 18. We'd drive out to the border. We'd have our 55 cents in our pocket. That you needed that 55 cents to throw into a hole with a window that you couldn't look into to cross back after a night of drinking. Because if you didn't have that 55 cents, you would get stopped. And we'd go in, we'd cross the border and just, you know, pay $7 for a drink and drown and kind of go crazy every single weekend. And we'd just do it on repeat for, you know, almost 2 years.
That casually?
Oh my God, it was so casual. Everyone knew what was going on. It was just looked over like it was nothing but, you know, thousands and thousands of high school children just going and getting drunk and then going back to the U.S. and driving home.
When did that change?
Mid-90s. And I started hearing in 98, 99, people were like, you know, you probably shouldn't go anymore. And then kind of never, you know, went back to that. That whole strip of bars was just literally, you know, wood, like covering the windows. It was just wasn't used. It was a ghost town.
He wasn't wrong. 2010 was the deadliest year in the war of Afghan civilians since the fall of the Taliban.
According to the UN, there were 2,777 Afghan casualties. Over in Juarez that same year, there were a reported 3,057 homicides.
Jesus. Those were only the homicides that were reported, too. You're also talking about a city with a population of only 1.3 million.
It hasn't slowed down either. According to KTSM, there have been 129 murders in Juarez already during the month of August.
You know we're still going, right?
Yeah. I know.
We drove to El Paso and took a ride-sharing service to the border.
We were going to walk across and meet our fixer, Julio, on the other side.
So, el pasaporte y el permiso lo presentas en el aeropuerto si vas en avión.
Uh-huh.
Si vas por tierra, la autoridad migratoria, si te lo pide, les dices que ya llevas tu permiso.
Gracias.
So, just like that, it was happening. We were in Mexico. Alex set us up with a guy named Julio Chaparra, our fixer.
For those of you that don't know, a fixer is a local journalist with connections to the community. They help you find sources, track down leads, translate, and take care of any need a foreign outlet could have.
That was certainly the case with Julio. He's worked with every large international news outlet you can think of. He's used to foreigners asking him to take them to maquiladores, interview locals, or set up a recording with a masked cartel sicario. This was different, though. Something a little unexpected.
We met Julio in a parking lot on the Mexican side of the border. Julio escorted us into a maroon-colored van with peeling paint.
Juarez, over here!
Julio?
Yeah, let me help you with their bags.
Ay, gracias.
Right this way.
Okay.
It was indiscreet, or at least as indiscreet as it could be.
Inside was a driver and a burly security guard. Both were wearing LA Dodgers jerseys, dark blue jeans, and gaudy Oakley sunglasses. Tucked away at both of their sides were semi-automatic rifles.
This is our driver, Pedro.
Hola.
Hola, Pedro. Muchas gracias.
Our security guy over here is Daniel. He used to work for the cartel as a sicario.
Hola, Elena. Mucho gusto.
Hola, Daniel. Muchas gracias.
The way he said that so casually caught me off guard. It was as if he was reading off Daniel's LinkedIn profile.
After formalities, we brought Julio up to speed.
Sounds like it's good I'm getting paid per hour. Before getting into the thick of the case, I thought it'd be good for you both to get a lay of the land, so to speak. I'd like to introduce you to my friend, Miguel de Leon.
Sounds good.
When we pulled up to Miguel's house, Pedro got out and let him take the wheel. It was clear we were going on Miguel's guided tour of Juarez.
Bueno, yo nací aquí en Ciudad Juárez. Soy Miguel Ángel Chávez Díaz de León.
I'm Miguel Ángel Díaz de León. I was born in Juarez and have been a journalist since I was 28. I don't use my name anymore. I write with a pseudonym because of how dangerous the city is. We're traveling on Camino Real, which is a road that goes all around the city. It has a view of all of Juarez, and also it's a place where killers throw many bodies. All the bodies here are of murdered people.
That many bodies?
Todos los días siempre hay uno.
There's one every day.
Todos los días.
Every single day.
At that frequency, local police must be aware of the situation. But what are they doing to stop it?
No hay vigilancia, no hay policía. La policía no viene.
Here, there's no surveillance. The police does not pass through here.
So there's no risk to a killer?
No, no.
No risk at all. They know that they can throw them here without any problem. They find men and women here.
Well, what about that sign over there below the mountain? I can't quite read it. What does it say?
Lee la Biblia.
It says, do you read the Bible? And I will tell you that they dump many corpses here.
Before we dive in any further, it is important to understand the history and scope of the femicide in this city. Much of that history has been colored by the handling of these cases by the police.
Since 1993, there have been 370 confirmed murders of women in Juarez. No one knows the actual number of those missing.
We have seen some estimates as high as 3,000 women. As stated in the first episode, many of the victims were young women who worked in the maquiladoras or factories outside of town. Similarities across many of the cases also include the torture, mutilation, and rape of the victims.
The police that investigated these crimes were accused of serious investigative negligence. Many have pointed their fingers at the cartel, including Johan Hari.
Well, the entire police force in Juarez worked for the drug cartels. You couldn't be a police officer and not work for them. You would have been killed. And lots of police officers who were honorable were killed. There's a phrase in Spanish, plato o plomo, right? Silver or lead. It basically means if you're a police officer, or anyone they want to intimidate or buy, if you agree to work with us, we'll give you a little bit of a bribe, and if you don't, we'll give you a bullet, we'll kill you, right? The Zetas and rival drug gangs bought the police.
When talking with Miguel, it soon became apparent how much of a stranglehold the cartel had on his life as well.
Were you scared to write about the cartels in your book?
At first, I was afraid because I didn't know how they would react. I make fun of them in the novel.
Did they give you any gifts?
Yes. There was a narco who sent his assistants and bought 50 novels. He also wanted me to read them on a ranch. I mean, I had to attend. It was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. There was the narco boss, and he had this ranch. I was going to have a big party, and I was not a kidnapped guest, but I got paid $1,000, and they bought all those novels.
But you didn't have to go, did you?
I pretty much had to accept. He showed me photos of my family at our house.
And that was when the conversation shifted.
Speaking of which, I need to make a quick phone call.
Okay.
Hola, jefe. Sí, buenas tardes, habla Julio.
While eavesdropping on this conversation, my American brain was telling me one thing, that Julio must be on the phone with his contacts working on setting up our next interview, that he was our rock, our great connector in a foreign, dangerous land. Though if there is one thing I learned so far on this trip, it was that finding truth in Juarez is like peeling back layers of a rotten onion. You know something below is rancid, you just don't know how close it is.
I just talked to the cartel. They'd like to have a word with you both before we get started.
What?
To take proper precautions, I thought it'd be best if we run everything by them and ask for their blessing.
You can't be serious.
Thanks for thinking ahead, Julio. Let us know what we need to be cognizant of when speaking to them.
Of course.
We dropped Miguel off back at his house and made our way to the cartel stronghold.
It'd be best if you leave the recorder inside, at least until we can get El Patron's permission.
Oh, okay.
Walking into that building was one of the longest moments of my life. It was almost as if time slowed to a stop. I locked eyes with everyone, fixated on every detail, and shut down to a state of pensive silence. When Julio brought us inside, we sat down with a local cartel leader who wished to remain anonymous.
Essentially, he wanted to know who we were, what we were doing, and who we were looking for.
Interestingly enough, he welcomed our inquiries. Much like El Carnicero, he didn't want the cartel to be associated with the Rubdeck murders.
Seems like everyone's concerned about branding these days, which made our lives a hell of a lot easier.
They even offered to help with whatever we needed and went as far as to say we'd be taken care of in Juarez.
So we quickly thanked them and headed back to our car.
So, to the police station? I think it'd be a good idea to meet the chief and see if he has leads on any similar crimes.
Not quite. We've got one more stop first.
The Juarez heat was sweltering. My whole body felt like an armpit, which is why we were grateful that Motel Cortez had air conditioning. It was one of those small, pink Pueblo-style adobe buildings that aren't uncommon in cities along both sides of the border.
Why were we here? Because the original ping on Headless, the Rubdeck killer's StreamLeak account, was logged from this IP address in 2006, a full year before the Rubdeck killings took place.
We weren't anticipating anything concrete from here, but it was worth a try.
I'll do the talking. I know the locals.
Hola, ¿quieres una habitación? ¿Habitaciones, tal vez?
She's asking if we want a room, or some rooms, maybe.
Actually, we'd like to ask you a few questions.
Está bien. Nos gustaría hacerte unas pocas preguntas.
¿Es usted policía? No hablo con policías.
No, no, not police, just journalists. Just a few questions and then we'll leave.
No. No somos policía. Somos periodistas. Solo unas pocas preguntas y luego nos iremos.
Va, okay. Bien, sigue adelante.
Okay. Ask away.
Did you work here in 2007?
¿Trabajaste aquí en 2007?
Sí, soy dueña del lugar. Lo tengo desde el 91.
She says, yeah, she owns the place. Has since 91.
Does she keep records, like a guest book?
¿Mantiene algún archivo, algún libro de huéspedes?
Sí, pero no de esos tiempos.
She says, yeah, but not that far back.
Shit. Well, did she notice anything strange back then? Any weird guests, an American?
Pues usted no se acuerda de alguna cosa rara en esos tiempos? Un huésped raro, extraño, un americano.
No sé. Tal vez, probablemente. Eso fue hace 13 años. ¿Cómo chingados esperas que me acuerde?
She says she doesn't know. Maybe, probably. It was 13 years ago. Not really sure if she remembers.
Solo vete aquí. No puedo ayudarte.
What's she saying?
She's saying it's time to leave.
Before we get into what happened next, let's hear a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey guys, so something I was putting off forever, and I've always put it off, and I probably will forever put off, is furniture shopping until Article.com. Instead of driving to warehouses to shop for the piece that you want, Article's online catalog features high-quality pieces that you can browse right at home on your iPhone, on your computer, on your iPad. Article's team of designers have a great eye to today's trends, but also focus on timeless design and great quality. Plus, in-stock items ship in 2 weeks or less. I got my Sven Oxford Blue 72-inch sofa within 4 days, and I love it. So it's blue, but it has like this little like breakup leather feel, so it looks worn, but it's pretty badass. Article is able to offer really low prices by cutting out the middleman and sell directly to you. So no showrooms, no salespeople, no retail markups. You can save up to 30% over traditional retail prices, so it's a no-brainer. So right now,
Article is offering Sierra Blanca listeners, that's you, $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. So go right to, right now, article.com/Blanca. And the discount will be applied automatically at checkout. That's article.com/Blanca to get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. article.com/BLANCA. Buffy makes super soft, earth-friendly bedding. Everything is made from ultra-smooth eucalyptus fiber that feels softer than cotton. I have one at home and love it. I never want to leave my Buffy and can't recommend them enough. They are made with eucalyptus fiber that is breathable and cool to the touch to help maintain the ideal sleeping temperature and feel cozy without overheating. They offer everything, from cult favorite comforters to pillows and sheets, to turn your bed into a calming comfort zone. Buffy is also great for the environment. Eucalyptus fiber isn't just softer than cotton, but more earth-friendly. It's sourced from renewable forests, consumes 10 times less water to grow, and is transformed with ultra-smooth fiber through a waste-free production process. For $20 off your bedding, visit buffy.co and enter Blanca. That's buffy.co, not com, and enter BLANCA for $20 off your Buffy bedding. Buffy.co, offer code Blanca.
You okay?
Yeah,
I'm fine.
Before heading to the police station, there's someone I want you to meet. His name is Manuel, and he can give you a bit of background on the police investigations surrounding the femicide.
Sounds great.
Julio drove us to a local restaurant where we sat down with Manuel.
Manuel Esparza was a prosecutor, forensics expert, and investigator at the Chihuahua Attorney General's office. He also headed the Organized Crime Homicide and Women's Homicide Investigation Units between 1998 and 2004 in Juarez.
As we mentioned before, many police working on the femicide cases were continuously accused of negligence.
One particular example that comes to mind is the case of Abdul Latif Sharif.
He was an Egyptian citizen. He actually came into the States back in the 1970s. He was a chemist. He had several incidents of sexual abuse against women, several rape cases. Last one in Texas, he was actually going to be the subject of a deportation hearing from the government. And he decided to self-deport into Mexico. We actually had these particular cases where the girls were being raped and strangled, raped and murdered. And we had, I think it was about four or five of them that we thought were related to him directly. One of these girls escapes from the second story of his home. She actually jumps out a second story window, completely naked, to find a police car and ask for help because she was being raped. So that's when they apprehended him.
Even with Sharif's dismal history and obvious evidence against him, these charges were initially dismissed. The court found that, contrary to the claims of the victim, Blanca Diaz, there were no physical signs of sexual abuse.
However, under mounting pressure, the government decided his criminal background made him the ideal candidate for their serial killer suspect. So they charged him for the multiple homicides.
Sharif was sentenced to 60 years in prison, though murders still continued with similar modus operandi and at the same pace, even while he was in jail. This led many to question his guilt, though that wasn't what Manuel believed.
That was a very lengthy investigation where we actually had undercover officers go into the downtown area in Juarez and become part of the gang that was committing the murders.
The police actually believed Sharif hired a crew to continue to rape and kill women while he was in prison.
Basically, they were doing the murders to take the blame off of him. And they actually told us Sharif was paying us $1,500 to commit two murders a month. It sounds like fiction. It sounds like something that's not real, that's too good to be true for an investigator. And Sharif came to be the first serial killer to actually revive his fantasies through other people.
When we pressed him further on this sensational story, Manuel preferred to extrapolate further on the exploits of Sharif's gang.
These people on the first group, they were actually bringing the newspapers to him with the stories of how the victims were found. In the other group, one of the group members, the one that actually had been to prison, was visiting Sharif. And when he came to visit, he would be wearing the underwear of the victims. And he would pull down his pants so that Sharif would see the underwear of that particular victim.
Ugh.
As harrowing as that sounds, this can't be the complete truth. There was probably a combination of several serial killers with different motives that were responsible for all these deaths.
The serial killer with the most proven victims is Luis Garavito. He killed at least 138 children, but did it in three different countries. We are dealing with several times that in one city. So I tend to agree. There have been some other suspects besides Sharif over the years, one of which was Pedro Padilla Flores. In 1986, he was arrested and confessed to a total of 30 murders. Three of them were confirmed.
All three women were sexually assaulted and strangled to death.
In 1990, he escaped from prison and was at large for 24 years before being apprehended by ICE in Mississippi, of all places. Then he was deported back to Mexico.
I think that might be one of the only times I thank God for ICE.
Obviously, he could have committed other murders in Juarez in his 24 years on the run.
Though we do know Flores isn't our guy. When he was arrested in the U.S., he had to submit DNA to CODIS. So if he was the Rubdeck killer, his DNA would have popped up in the system.
That makes sense, too. Clearly, Flores had a sexual MO, whereas the Rubdeck killings did not.
Then there are the Ciudad Juarez rebels, who were a gang of serial killers who confessed to murdering eight women in 1996.
One of the members, Jose Francisco, spoke about how he murdered women in Juarez under the influence of drugs for the purpose of performing satanic rituals. His partner even used to dissect the hearts of his victims when he was done. After their arrest, the femicide death toll didn't waver either. You can find that clip on YouTube.
Another theory for a large number of the missing women were that they were abducted, then forced into sex trafficking by the Juarez cartel.
Currently, there's a case where six members are being accused of kidnapping and murdering 11 women.
There were even 158 witnesses who testified against them in court. A number of them said they even saw these men kidnapping women in plain sight.
Another even testified he was responsible for bribing the police to turn a blind eye on the operation.
Hell, even the police are suspect.
I don't know if you saw that there were some protests yesterday. A girl was raped by four police officers in Mexico City. So now you have protests all over Mexico saying the police has to protect us, not rape us.
So the killers could be anyone.
When researching cases of this magnitude in the U.S. or Canada, there is a wealth of information. There are multiple books, documentaries on virtually every serial killer. In Juarez, there is so little written about all of it. I couldn't even find a video clip online of Abdul Latif Sharif.
The more I think about it, the more this all leads me to believe
that if there is any place on Earth where someone could quietly develop the Rubdeck device, as the letter sent to Dr. Lopez suggested, it's Juarez.
That being said, we needed to make sure that we avoided making waves against the cartels or any violent group there at all costs.
In other words, we had to tread lightly. We wrapped our meal and headed to the police station to see if there were any victims that shared similar traits as the Rubdeck victims.
Right this way. The chief of police here in Juarez is going to meet us. His name is Jesus Oala.
What a thankless job.
He's doing his best. People have cracked under a lot less pressure than this.
It was almost as if Julio was apologizing before anything even happened.
We waited in Chief Soala's office for 45 minutes. It was pure chaos.
Every minute there gave me a tiny window into the kind of horrid situation that Soala had to deal with on a daily basis.
Finally, after what felt like a lifetime, he welcomed us into his office.
Buenos dias. A pleasure to meet you both.
After assuring him of the cartel's blessing, we shared the details of the Rubdek case with him, as well as the letter.
Nothing fazed him. Sowala's facial expression was not merely that of a man who'd seen suffering, but a man who lived on the front doorsteps of hell.
Though there was one facet of the case that caught his attention.
Excuse me, did you say Mexican train dominoes?
Yeah, he used those to make all the Rubdek devices.
Can you excuse me for 5 minutes?
Of course.
He knew something.
Though we couldn't push the envelope, we had to be patient.
So here's the situation. Sowala got a tip from a bus driver about a dump site marked with Mexican train dominoes a couple of years back. Apparently, he never investigated it.
I assume the reason was that he was scared what he'd learn, afraid who it might have pointed towards.
It's important to keep in mind we're in Mexico. Here, there's a solve rate of 5 convictions for every 100 homicide victims. There's a reason for that.
So Chief Sowala gave Julio the number of the driver who made the tip, and he called him. Luckily, he was persuaded to meet us.
The man wanted to remain anonymous, so we agreed to call him Willie.
A few years ago, I can't be exact, I was driving my route and there were 2 passengers in the first row. These 2 dumb kids in their 20s.
Yeah?
Judging from their conversation, I think they were young Sicario wannabes trying to break into the cartel.
So what happened?
One of them was talking about going deep into the desert to run some chore. It was the middle of the day, smoldering hot, and he went with one of his accomplices to hide something. They drove west on Highway 2 until they passed a cactus in the shape of the cross. His friend took that to be divine intervention, a sign from God that they found their spot. The kid's stomach just tied up in knots. Something felt off. They walked 5 miles north into the desert, drinking as much water as they could until they knew they were far enough away from the highway. Somewhere civilization forgot about. Somewhere no one had any business being. Before they started digging, he noticed these strange dominoes on the ground. Dominoes that went up to double 12s.
Mexican train dominoes.
It terrified the kid. It was strange because there was no sign of humanity in that desert. So to find dominoes there was not normal. But that didn't stop them. The kids started digging. In their third hole, one of the kids was getting frustrated. He thought he kept hitting a rock, which was weird since there were no problems with the first 2. After digging around it, they slowly uncovered 2 decapitated bodies.
And what did they do?
I remember him saying that they covered up the hole and left one of the weird dominoes near the road. That way, the other would know to avoid it. Right when I heard that story, I called in to the police with the location that was given, and that was that.
And what did they do about it?
Cartel violence and proper police response don't go hand in hand. They did what they could, fucking nothing.
Willie, we appreciate you sharing this information. I'm just wondering, why did you feel it was necessary to hide your identity in this interview?
It is hard to be a bus driver in Juarez. Not everyone holds us in such high regard.
I knew what he was referring to. In 2013, a woman with platinum blonde hair shot and killed 2 different bus drivers within 24 hours on the exact same route.
A day later, La Polaca, an El Paso news outlet, received this email.
You think that because we are women, we are weak. And that may be true, but only up to a point. Because even though we have nobody to defend us, and we have to work long hours until late into the night to earn a living for our families, we can no longer be silent in the face of these acts that enrage us. We were victims of sexual violence from bus drivers working in maquila night shifts here in Juarez. And although a lot of people know about the things we've suffered, nobody defends us nor does anything to protect us. That's why I am an instrument that will take revenge for many women. For we are seen as weak, but in reality, we are not. We are brave. And if we don't get respect, we will earn that respect with our own hands. We, the women of Juarez, are strong.
The email was signed Diana, Huntress of Bus Drivers. This American Life did a fascinating episode on Diana, and we highly recommend checking it out.
In that piece, it seemed that most of the local women they talked to saw Diana favorably. One woman interviewed even went as far as to say that if she met Diana on the street, she would congratulate her.
In other words, if someone like Willie got shot in the back of the head, his murder investigation wouldn't exactly be prioritized.
So I understand his need for anonymity.
That being said, there was one thing I didn't understand. How do you know where this dump site is?
The kid said it. I'll never forget.
But how can you remember something as specific as an address from a conversation you heard years ago?
How is that possible?
Tranquila. He was talking about where to find headless corpses. I think you remember that.
At this point, something wasn't adding up. His account was too detailed. Maybe he'd seen something or been a part of something that he didn't want uncovered.
Besides that, and a less than favorable public opinion, there seems to also be quite a history of Mexican bus drivers getting caught in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Cartel members have had numerous documented instances of mass abductions from buses that have led to torture and death.
The most recent incident involved the death of 43 students in 2014. The students of a local teacher's college were known to commandeer public buses for protests and return them afterwards. Although no one knows exactly what happened, it's believed that organized crime worked hand in hand with police to commit the kidnapping and murders of these students.
So it seems the bus drivers are always at the wrong place at the wrong time. That being said, I didn't let Willie off the hook just yet.
How do you know the kid wasn't lying?
Because I know.
The kids lie all the time.
Want me to take you there? You can see for yourself.
Of course.
Wait, did you see it? Did you see the dump site?
Do I really have to say it?
Have to say what?
The reason I remember is because I was that fucking kid.
Jesus.
They were dark times. I needed money. Never hurt anybody.
Nobody's accusing you of that.
Sometimes I drove people. They wanted to go all kinds of places. It's all foggy, but this one guy, he took two women with him. Like girlfriends. Same guy, different women. Two trips.
And what did he look like?
I don't remember, but he spoke Spanish. I remember that much. He went right there and right back. The women never came back with him, and I didn't say shit. I walked out to the desert because I wanted to know. I wanted to know what I led them into. Nothing. Just those fucking dominoes like breadcrumbs. I just knew they were dead.
Willie, when can you take us? Tomorrow?
This whole week is going to be over 39 degrees during the day.
For all you Americans listening, that's over 102 degrees Fahrenheit.
We're also going to need a digging crew and proper machinery.
I can take care of putting that all together.
Sounds good. Also, temperature-wise, the best time to go dig is in the dead of night.
Okay, I guess we'll at least avoid heat stroke.
Well, let's get this set up.
Okay, but I'm warning you. Whatever we find there, it's not going to be pleasant.
On the next episode of The Heads of Sierra Blanca, we'll be heading to the burial ground in the dead of night. Who knows what we'll find?
Thank you for joining us.
Follow us on social media for updates at Heads of Sierra Blanca on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Our website is www.headsofsierrablanca.com, where you can listen to the show and support us by buying our merch. If you have any tips, please leave a message on our voicemail. The number is 915-213-4292. That's 915-213-4292. We'll see you on the next episode of The Heads of Sierra Blanca.